I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is a shot at seeing ourselves as others see us, with one of the great reporters on American politics, up close sometimes, and this time from Oxford, England. 40 years ago, Godfrey Hodgson was one of the three young London writers who wrote an American melodrama on the presidential campaign of 1968. Nixon Agnew over Humphrey Muskie after the infighting with Lyndon Johnson and Gene McCarthy was over, and after, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy had been killed. I've been rereading that classic book, Godfrey Hodgson, and I got to say, it's better than ever. You out-teddied Teddy White in The Making of the President Chronicles. The book is just as good, I think, as the great Norman Mailer histories of the same events that are just being republished and much talked about in the States this summer. So can we talk about this 2008 campaign in the context of 40 years? The candidates, the crisis, the media coverage, the issues, in the light of your virtual lifetime submersion in American power. Godfrey Hodgson, give us the 2008 campaign as you see it in bold strokes.
Okay, sure. Well, I expected, and I dare say I hoped, that 2008 would be what the political scientists call a realignment, a critical election. Those are the terms they use. What I mean by that is that the one big thing I think we got wrong in 68 is that we didn't understand entirely the force and power of the conservative wave, which was just about to hit. Now, in 64, when the Goldwater campaign collapsed and Lyndon Johnson won by a record margin, nobody really noticed the other things that were going on, the emergence of Ronald Reagan, the way in which conservative institutions were being built. It seemed to me that we got that wrong in 68. And what I hoped we would see in 2008, it was the end of that conservative ascendancy. I myself wrote a book about conservatism. I tried to be as fair as I could to it, but it did seem to me that some things had gone badly wrong. Not just the war in Iraq, but some things in American society, in particular the incredible increase in inequality, and really the creation of something close to just the kind of class society which we in Britain have been wrestling and struggling to do away with for the last 50 years. So I was hoping that 08 would be a realignment. I don't think it has been a realignment. Now, it seems to me that much of the campaign, as filtered through the media, has not really focused on the big questions. There's been a lot of attention paid, first of all, an amazing amount of attention paid to how much money each of the candidates had. I mean, John McCain, who I met a couple of times and who I used to greatly respect because of his history, there was a point in which it was announced that he was no longer a candidate because he didn't have enough money. He did have enough money, and Republicans tend to be able to put their hands on a few bob when they need it. But throughout the early stages of the election, the pre-primary and the early primaries, a lot of the reporting was all about people's war chests, not about their ideas or what they stood for. Now, amazingly, it turns out that Barack Obama, this man with a funny name, as he says himself, turned out to be able to release almost infinite quantities of money. Why? Well, partly because of his skill at using the internet, and that's a subtopic of some interest, I think. But that was the first thing. The second thing is that everybody said they wanted change. In particular, Senator Obama said he wanted change. But this produced a response in the people you saw, the people who were being interviewed in the primaries, that was almost neuralgic. It was almost as though what they wanted was not change, but therapy. The extraordinary is weepy. It's like a third great awakening, even in Denver, actually, with people. One woman I heard interviewed by the great Jim Noxey, was she said, oh, well, I wasn't at all sure that I could accept Barack Obama until halfway through Hillary's speech when I began weeping, so I realized I could support Obama. I thought this is astonishing.
Well, this is the advance of psychobabble in absolutely everything, yes. I suppose. But go back a sec. When you say you no longer expect a realignment or a defining election or a break in the conservative reign, is that assuming that McCain will win, or do you think also that Barack is not the change that he professes to be?
Well, it's not that I expect McCain to win, though I think it's still possible that he will win. We can talk about that. It's not that I think that Obama doesn't want change. I think he wants it passionately with every fiber of his soul. But I just don't think the election is going in such a way that it would be very easy for him to achieve change. One thing I'm quite struck by is how this is going to be a foreign policy election, just as actually 1960 was a foreign policy election. 1968 was not wholly, but there was, of course, the tremendous underlying theme of Vietnam and what was implied by that. But I do think it's a foreign policy election. I think the Republicans want to make it a foreign policy election. After all, what they seem to understand by foreign policy is national security and military affairs. It's interesting to me that everybody says Obama doesn't have relevant experience because he wasn't on the Armed Services Committee. Well, he was on the Foreign Relations Committee, which, you know, at least in theory, is the committee which has primary responsibility for foreign relations. And there is, I think, there's a sense in which the Republicans are having some success in making the issues these issues of national security.
They make them as jibes on cable television and in quick commercials. I wonder. I don't know if you heard Joe Biden ticking off rather an impressive argument last night about issues on which McCain, he said, had been wrong. Obama had been right. Who cares really? Who was on what committee? When matters of big judgment are at stake.
No, the reason I mentioned that is just that the extent to which foreign relations have been redefined by the Republicans over the last considerable period of time as being essentially military and national security issues. Of course, it's also the case that McCain has many more years' experience in the Senate than Obama has. But I do think that it is going to be a foreign policy election. We've got two enormous events, I think, which really signal the collapse of the Bush foreign policy. One is the overthrow of Musharraf in Pakistan, which means that the tribal areas where the Taliban and possibly Osama bin Laden are, you know, having their safe haven, are probably not going to be accessible to the United States. That poses a problem, I think, particularly for Obama, because he's spoken of being willing to go in there if it were identified that Osama was there. But that's just one example. The other example, obviously, is the Georgia and post-Georgia, let's call it the Black Sea crisis, with the events in the Ukraine. I mean, that it seems to me to be a demonstration of the failure of the Bush administration's foreign policy. I mean, they support the independence, the sovereign independence of Georgia, but at the same time, they put up the Secretary of Defense, say there's nothing we can do about it. And then they send some warships into the Black Sea. What are they supposed to be doing? It does seem to me that, that's two issues that are going to dominate the next few weeks of political discourse.
I wonder if they'll even stack up anywhere close to just the general impression of China in the Beijing Olympics and the realization that China is here in a very big way.
Well, I think China is a major player. I think actually there's also some strange attitudes to China in the United States. One of them is that in some curious way, there's still this lurking idea that goes back, I guess, to Franklin Roosevelt and even beyond, that somehow China is our, these are our folks. They're the people we're going to sort out the world with hand in hand. Whereas, in fact, it seems to me China is the most dangerous rival to the United States and is, after all, though nobody seems to remember this, is, after all, a communist tyranny. It's also a communist tyranny which is embracing capitalism in a number of respects, very successfully. But it does seem to me there's some very odd attitudes to China in the United States.
Godfrey Hutchins, you wrote 40 years ago in an American melodrama that one reason for writing about American politics is that it matters, but another reason is that it's so often entertaining. I wonder if you'd rate the 2008 campaign both for substance and for showbiz.
Well, I think they're very, very important issues at stake, both for the United States and for the world in 2008. As for entertainment, I haven't been on the bus. I haven't been there as I was in 64, 68, 72, 76. But I don't think it's been as entertaining. Maybe I would feel differently if I had been there up close. But it seems to me it hasn't been a bundle of laughs. Whereas until Bob Kennedy was murdered, I thoroughly enjoyed 1968. It was my annus mirabilis because I covered the Prague Spring. And then on the way back to Washington, I was told to turn around and cover the events of May in Paris. And then I covered I was the leader, one of the two leaders of a team of several reporters covering the 68 U.S. election. So it was a great time up until the day when, we had an appointment to see Bob Kennedy in his suite in the Ambassador Hotel later that evening. And by God, he was killed more or less in front of our eyes, actually.
Does American politics matter in 08 the way it did in 68?
Well, I think it does, absolutely. I mean, I think it's hard to exaggerate the damage that the Bush administration and its supporters have done to the reputation of the United States. It seems to me that any time you have a fellow who says he thinks the Geneva Conventions, or at least some of them, are quaint, and is thereupon promoted to be the Attorney General of the United States, something has gone rather badly wrong. I mean, that's the sort of thing which troubles us around the world, I think.
Striking to me, again, reading your book for perspective, that the big issues are so similar and so different. Race, the civil rights movement, riots, the assassination of Dr. King, these were burning issues in 68. Obama personifies a huge change across the board in race relations in the United States. But then the other big issue in 68 is ever more in the forefront, the question of the American imperium in the world, an overextension
Absolutely.
Of American power at war in Vietnam, then at war in the Middle East today. I mean, what does that tell you, that the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Well, I think there's one underlying question, really, for American public life to address, and that is indeed the question of what role the United States will have in the world. I think at the moment it's inevitable that the United States must be the leader. But I think also you remember the 1850s British song, we don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the ships, we've got the men, and we've got the money too. And it seems to me that it's dealing with that, the echo in American society of that kind of ridiculous chauvinism, which is a very important issue. And I'll give you a silly example, which may or may not resonate. And that is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, everybody in the United States started writing about how the United States had become the lone superpower. Now, that's not the ordinary English way of saying that. The ordinary English way of saying that would say the only superpower, the lone superpower, is a poetic, archaic poetic word with unmistakable echoes of the Lone Ranger, radio show of the 1940s, etc. Do you see what I mean? There's a kind of hokum in feelings about this and some quarters, which I think is fearfully dangerous.
I was struck by Gene McCarthy's very tart, specific language around foreign policy in the 68 campaign. There's nothing quite like it. The issues are still there, but there's nothing like his phrasing of them. Here's what he said in a late exchange with Robert Kennedy. He said teasing Robert Kennedy in a certain way about his brother John and his own Cold War policies as president. McCarthy said, and it could be said today too, although it's not, McCarthy said, the foundation of American foreign policy has remained the same as it was in the early 50s and in the 60s, containment and a continuation of the Cold War, some new sails on the ships, some new rhetoric. Instead of containment, it's counterinsurgency now, but no difference in the policy, essentially the same diplomacy, assuming for itself the role of the world's judge and the world's policeman. He was talking much more clearly than we do about the same issues today, it seems to me.
I think so. I was very struck by a column by William Crystal in which he said, if people want to call us an empire, well, fine, he said. And that really struck me because since I was an undergraduate, since I was at school even, I'd always understood that the United States was passionately opposed to imperialism. And, you know, we'd sat at the feet of Franklin Roosevelt when he explained to us why we should oppose imperialism. And my generation of people in England, the primary issue that moved us was our desire to cease being imperialist. And to have Mr. Crystal Jr. Saying it's fine to say the United States is imperialist struck me as just how far the center of gravity had moved under the conservative ascendancy.
He probably wrote it in that New York Times column of his, too.
Yes, I think he did.
I mean, the venue tells you something.
Yeah, but it may have been in the Standard, too. I'm not sure. But in any case, he may have just been impatient and irritated with somebody, you know, blowing off, as it were. But it did strike me as very odd. And I do think that, I mean, the reaction to events in Georgia, and I may say the reaction of our government in Britain as well, has been very strange. I mean, it seems to me that to promise NATO membership to Georgia, which is a small country which the Defense Department itself admits is indefensible, and on the other hand to Ukraine, which is a very large country, which is really, if it were to become a NATO member, that really would be seen, I suppose, by Russians as a spear pointed at their heart. And it seems to me that there's a set of assumptions there which have much more to do really with self-praise and self-pleasing than they do with a rational calculation of America's proper interests.
Godfrey Hutchin, I'd like you to kind of review the talent in the 08 campaign that we've seen so far. And then I'd also like you to kind of rate the new powers in American politics. The establishment that you wrote about in 1968 has been so changed by many things. But first, just take the candidates, if you would, starting with the nominees, McCain and Obama, and their running mates, and the people they beat. What do you make of this lot?
Well, I think McCain is the most impressive person, as I have met him twice, and I found him pleasant, intelligent, and formidable. I also was very impressed. I reviewed a book by Admiral Stockdale, who also was a prisoner in Hanoi, and he described how young McCain, who was a junior officer, earned the respect and admiration of older and senior men by both his courage, but also his wisdom. So we start with a man who is a formidable human being. He then turns out to have had a career in the Senate in which he was, the phrase that's used is a maverick, but I think he was more of a kind of an independent Republican. And then since the campaign began, he has moved steadily into being almost indistinguishable from George W. Bush, and in some respects even further out. I mean, when he talks about staying in Iraq for 100 years, that makes one's hair curl. He appears to be in favor of taxation reform, which would reduce taxes even more for very wealthy people like him, or at least like his wife, and would not help ordinary folks at all much. So he does seem to me to have moved to the right. Now, of course, in the logic of electoral politics, that may be the necessary or the advantageous, the expedient thing to do, but I've been disappointed by that. Now, on the other hand, I've not met Barack Obama, but I have read both of his two books very carefully. And the first thing to be said is that his first book, his autobiography, is, in my opinion, an absolutely magnificent book. It's a subtle book. It's full of human wisdom. The way in which he looks at the United States, both, as it were, from inside and from outside at the same time. The way he deploys these characters, his family, his American family, his Kenyan family, almost like a novelist does, but he paints them through incidents rather than directly. I mean, he's clearly an extremely intelligent man, even if we didn't know that he passed top of the Harvard Law School. He's a very, very bright man, and he's a brilliant orator. On the other hand, he also is somebody who, having considerable advantages, including his Harvard record, chose to deploy himself in pretty unglamorous activity when all sorts of more glamorous activity would have been available to him. So, yes, I admire and respect him. I think he's a very interesting man. I do think that he has failed really to articulate, to my understanding, what he really means by this change he's talking about. If it's just a question of getting rid of George W. Bush, well, sure, almost all of us want that. Is he really talking about substituting for the conservative ascendancy a society which is less canted in favor of the rich and the privileged? Is he really talking about a more, a more friendly, amicable relationship with the rest of the world? I can see that he's constantly under pressure of events to move to the center, not to scare people. But at the same time, I really would like to hear him articulate his political beliefs as, for example, Franklin Roosevelt did in the 100 Days.
What did the campaign lose in the defeat of Hillary Clinton, do you think?
Well, I have a great sympathy for her and for her supporters. It seems to me that it lost one thing, which is it lost, at least for a while, the coherence and the comity of the Democratic Party. I think it's also, you have this difficult thing. Is it more important for the United States to appoint an African-American or a woman, or to choose an African-American or a woman, both of those things inconceivable 40 years ago, but pretty much. And I think both of those things would have been good to achieve. But as it happened, by a rather narrow margin, and some would say by no margin at all, it was Hillary Clinton who lost out. I thought that the Clintons and the Clinton partisans were a little grudging and ungracious, although they certainly made up for it okay once they got to Denver. I do think that I think it's important not to not to demonize Hillary Clinton. I mean, it seems to me she fought a very gallant campaign, and she did articulate some real principles, which are good ones. If I had to choose, if I were an American citizen, I had the vote, I would have voted for Barack Obama, but only by a margin and only after fairly serious thought.
Godfrey Hutchinson, I'm wondering how the sort of the fundamental underpinnings of American political power look to you 40 years after your, may I say, masterpiece, but also across the Atlantic Ocean. What strikes me from the long perspective is that so many establishments of real power have gone, and that
you're absolutely right.
The coherence, in a way, of American power is still a mystery. In 40 years ago, the power of the newspapers, the power of the unions especially, not to mention city bosses, of Lyndon Johnson, a discredited president who wasn't running, still owned that convention. Mm-hmm. But the unions were quite able to dry up Robert Kennedy's money in that in those late campaigns. There's nothing like that order, for better or worse.
We can check them off. I mean, the city machines have gone. In 1972, I made a film about the Democratic Convention, and there still were residual smoke-filled rooms, residual bosses. I remember doing an interview with Pete Camille of Philadelphia, for example. He was a classic city boss. But that's gone. That's number one. Number two, Detroit has gone. I mean, the big three automakers have just gone cap in hand to the administration, asking them for, I think it's $25 billion, because they're broke. The banks are sliding around on the floor. Wall Street, the old foreign policy establishment. I read a biography of Colonel Stimson. He and his friends, the Bundy brothers, who were so good to me in various ways, they've disappeared. They've simply been shot out of the ground. If I may say so, the New York Times and the Washington Post are not the powers in the world that they were in 1968 still. Almost every traditional source of power. You know the old John Gunther question was, you know, John Gunther would send a researcher ahead, book a suite in a big hotel in town, invite all the movers and shakers in town, give them a cocktail or two, and then say, who runs this place? Well, it's not possible to do that now, it seems to me. Now, there are other sources of power, of course. One of them, you'd have to say, would be our old friend Rupert Murdoch, who, with Fox News and with another Wall Street Journal, has built up possibly the greatest media empire in terms of political power and influence that anybody's ever. Perhaps that's bad history, but it seems to me that he is a very important part of what's happened. And the other thing, of course, is the creation of conservative institutions, the ones that Sidney Blumenthal wrote about in his book, I think it was called The Alternative Establishment, that it used to be that most of the powerful institutions in American life had a kind of default liberal position. That ain't true now. I do, and then you come to this very vexed, I think treacherous question of new media. My daughter works actually for Rupert Murdoch as a media reporter, as a media reporter based in California, and I talk to her all the time, obviously, and she's constantly stressing how big a shift that is, the shift of advertising to the internet, the way in which new technologies, new information technologies have really created new sources of power and weakened old centers of power. I think that's important. At the same time, there is a certain amount of claptrap about this too, I think. I mean, it's true that Howard Dean and then Barack Obama have been able to raise large amounts of money in small quantities, but that was always a possibility, I think. And it's true that the internet and blogging, you know, introduced... I mean, blogging, again, there's a lot of claptrap about that, it seems to me. A lot of blogging is just bloviating, and a lot of blogging is just old-fashioned journalism. The idea that somehow all everything that comes out in the form of a blog is somehow has the same political effect seems to me a dubious one. A long time ago, people were talking about how new technology would help the left, the young, the Democrats, but of course the people who could afford to use computers and the technologies derived from computers first were the Rockefellers. First politician to have a kind of new media campaign was Nelson Rockefeller. So I think one has to be very, very careful about that.
Interesting. You know, the John Gunther question is such a beauty, and it's maybe the way to wrap it up. I mean, who runs this place? Maybe that's really the interesting question, no matter who wins the race. Who will we decide at the end of the campaign really is in charge of the foundations? Do you want to take a guess?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that it would be nice to think that the people who run the place would turn out to be the American people. And I have a slight tendency at the end of books to have a kind of couple of paragraphs saying, well, after all, let's trust the wisdom and good sense of of the American people. And I do feel that at the same time. American history is full of the expertise with which various smaller groups of people have managed to represent themselves as the voice of the American people. John Caldwell Calhoun represented himself as the voice of the American people. So I do think that, I mean, I think the Democratic Party is an intensely interesting organization. And if Barack Obama can really retool the Democratic Party as an instrument of benign political change in the way that Franklin Roosevelt created the Roosevelt Coalition, which has now completely crumbled, then I think he will be a very great political leader. But it's going to be tough. And I think that he's going to be worked over quite a bit. I mean, the one thing we haven't talked about, really, is what I call subterranean racism. I mean, there is a sense in which, although Barack Obama is an American and an African, he's not really an African-American in the sense that he experienced the South Side of Chicago almost as a tourist. I mean, okay, as a committed social worker and a person committed to political action, but nevertheless, he doesn't have the same experience. He doesn't have the classic African-American experience. There is a sense in which many people find it easier to imagine him being president than if he were, for example, Jesse Jackson. At the same time, there are a lot of other people who still are reluctant, I think, really to accept the idea of an African-American president. I remember years ago interviewing President Kennedy's political right-hand man, Larry O'Brien.
Sure.
And he was a very wise guy, I thought. And he said to me, you know, it's that moment when they get in the booth and it's the gut that pulls the lever. I thought that was wonderful. And there is a sense in which there's an emotional dimension to politics everywhere. And Obama, I think, is not yet, and he speaks with the tongues of men and of angels. He's a brilliant orator. I'm not sure that he's yet been able to articulate the feelings of the majority.
We're going to learn a lot about the gut of the American voter, but you also make me think that although he's often compared for charismatic reasons, youth, glamour, and looks to John Kennedy, maybe the real foil, the real challenge to Obama in the next 2 months is to think of himself in Rooseveltian terms, Franklin Rooseveltian terms.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, to my mind, Franklin Roosevelt, who had his failings, as all humans do, but he really was the person who figured out how to make the presidency work. And I learned from a political scientist called Aaron Wildowski one thing about how he did it. He had basically four levers or connections that he used, one of which was the Congress, one of which was the Democratic Party, one of which is the bureaucracy or the permanent government, and one of which was the media. And I don't think any of those connections are still in good working order. And I think that it may be that some of those are not the right connections to use. I mean, the political party has really been utterly transformed by the process which began with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, in which the old traditional Democratic Party was destroyed, and the Republican Party became a conservative party, so that for the first time, really, until you go deep into the dark 19th century, for the first time you have a kind of European-style politics in America, where you have a party of the left and a party of the right. The French say the party of movement and the party of order. Now, it may be that the parties just aren't available to use in that way. It certainly seems to me that the media cannot be managed in that way, if only because of the internet and the bloggers and the multiplicity of people who have access to the bullhorn, as it were. The bureaucracy, everybody seems to have decided that bureaucracy is bad. They also seem to have decided that bureaucracy is something which only happens in the government. Although anybody who's ever tried to, you know, argue with an airline or a bank or an insurance company realizes that, you know, bureaucracy is to be found in the private sector too. But Max Weber, who invented the concept of the charismatic leader, always assumed that the destined fate of the charismatic leader was to create a bureaucratic leadership, that there was an almost inevitable progression, Weber taught, that you go from the charismatic leader to the organization, if you like, and this was his example, not mine, you go from Jesus Christ to the Apostle Paul, the man who organized the church as a powerful and enduring and efficient institution. I don't know whether it's possible to imagine a President Obama recreating a presidency which is as effective as the Roosevelt presidency was.
We're going to see, and we're going to talk with you again, Godfrey Hodgson, God willing. We love the long view, both in distance and in time. I mentioned your 68 book, An American Melodrama. I haven't mentioned some of the more recent ones, including America in Our Time, from World War II to Nixon, What Happened and Why, and also More Equal Than Others, a book on America from Nixon to the New Century. This is good fun, Godfrey Hodgson, and we'd love to do it again. We're so happy to be talking with you today.
I hope so, too. I look forward to it.
Thank you.